Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 17th of July. We're happy to have Jane Mayer with us this hour. This book is getting all kinds of attention this week. Frank Rich wrote a big column that spent a lot of time talking about her book, and she's described as this very thorough, wonderful journalist, and the book indicates that. I don't know if she got some of the information in here. Jane's book is The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. She is the co-author of two best-selling and critically acclaimed narrative nonfiction books, Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984 to 1988, and Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. That book was a finalist for the National Book Award. She was also awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship in connection with The Dark Side. Jane is currently a Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker. She specializes in political and investigative reporting. And before that, she was a senior writer and front page editor for The Wall Street Journal and was the journal's first female White House correspondent. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jane. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Email, you can do that as well, and that's talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org. Hi, Jane. Thanks for being with us.
I'm so glad to be with you.
You know, I remember so well when Dick Cheney talked with – I saw that interview with Tim Russert when he was talking about the dark side, and he's got this sort of dark side aura about him too. And I thought, oh, my gosh, where is the guy going? What is the dark side?
Well, that is – you know, I had exactly the same question. That is really the question that started this book, which is what does it mean when the head of our government says we're going to have to kind of work on the dark side and fight in the shadows, and it's a dirty business, but basically his feeling was we're going to have to fight terror with terror in some ways. And so 7 years later, I wanted to go back and see, well, what have we really been doing? And what is the dark side? And that's what this is a story of, is from the start. It starts right after 9/11 and tries to take us up through, almost through today. I had to finish writing in May in order to get the book out. And it's based on accounts of lots and lots of people inside the government, in and around the government, a lot of former CIA officers and others, who, many of whom I think told the story that most surprised me, which was that contrary to the sort of united front we see from the Bush administration saying that we don't torture and that we have to do these things in order to win the war on terror, inside the Bush administration itself, there have been so many people who have been just repelled by what's been going on. Mm-hmm. There are people who have had tremendous crises of conscience, mm-hmm. and have pushed back. There are lawyers inside the administration, tons of military people, FBI agents, who've basically said, this is torture, and we're not going to do it, and we are better than this as a country. And so this is it's not just the depressing story of what awful things have been done, because there have been some awful things done. It's also the story of a kind of a struggle, I think, for the soul of the country about, you know, how do we make ourselves safe without giving up our basic core ideals as a country.
Based in large part, would you say, because of, and I want you to outline his paranoia, Dick Cheney's, who obviously was spooked by September 11, but you talk about the fact that he became extremely paranoid. Is it based on Dick Cheney's paranoia?
Well, of course, I'm not a psychiatrist, and even if I were, I've never had the opportunity to put Dick Cheney on a couch. It would be interesting, but at any rate, I quote other people around him as saying that he became paranoid. There's a sort of incredible story that the book opens with, which describes how just a little more than a month after September 11th, 2001, after the al-Qaeda attacks, the White House had installed very sensitive sensors to just in case there were anthrax attacks or other kinds of bio or chemical or radiological weapons being used against the White House. And on October 18th, 2001, one of those alarms went off, and Cheney himself, according to two people I interviewed who are in a position to know, believed that he'd been exposed, possibly fatally, to some kind of pathogen. And he very calmly called the notified the NSC, the National Security Council, and announced the threat. And before too very long, they figured out that it was a false alarm. But you have to understand the mindset of what things were like inside the White House. The country was told that the president was resolute, and we were given a kind of a sense that they were in charge and calm inside. But in fact, there was really panic inside the White House, and it wasn't the only false alarm. There were a number of them, and it wasn't too long after that Vice President Cheney disappeared for quite a long time into one of his undisclosed locations. So people around him said that he changed after 9/11. I interviewed an old family friend who really likes him a lot, and who said that he became steely, and it was as if he had seen something terrible that he couldn't talk about. And so it may have affected his judgment, I do think, and the judgment of all the people who felt suddenly that they were targeted and that the country was in terrible peril.
And so the only response to that, and tell me why that would be their thinking, was to increase the power of the executive branch of government, to put all the power there, and to allow them to stamp on the Constitution and on this vision that people around the world had of America as a fair and just place, and to change the nature of our country.
Well, yeah, I mean, they basically felt, I think you can look at it a few ways, but they basically felt all the laws we've had, all the restraints we've had, the limits set by our Constitution, the checks on executive power that are in the Constitution that the other branches of government exert, all of this they looked at as impediments. They thought that the country itself was, its future was in peril, and we need to do whatever it takes, basically. And so that the ends of keeping America safe, in their view, justified just virtually any means. And so they also had an understanding of the president's power that was already eccentric to begin with, even before 9/11. And partly what I try to explain here is that to some extent you can look at this as these guys came into power, particularly Cheney, with a grudge and a kind of a political agenda. Cheney in particular really resented the post-Watergate reforms. He was in Washington in the Ford administration when a lot of curbs were put on the presidency after Nixon became so imperial that Congress sort of pushed back, and he always resented that.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the fear that 9/11 generated, they suddenly had the country's complete support and the world's support to do whatever they wanted to do. And there were a lot of things that he had long wanted to do. Cheney, in particular, had wanted to get rid of a lot of these curbs, like take the domestic wiretapping laws.
Right.
The court that was set up after Watergate, he and his top lawyer, David Addington, who may be the most powerful man that America has never heard of.
Right, right.
They had really resented that you had to go to a court before you could wiretap American citizens. And they thought that it was an unconstitutional infringement on the president's rights. And it was a law. It had been passed. It was constitutional, but it was on the books. But they went right past it. They blew right through it, in the words of one of the top White House lawyers after 9/11, because they didn't like it, and they felt that by making the war on terror into a war, not a criminal case against terrorists, the commander in chief had enhanced powers. He was basically saying that we need to do this for a national defense. And so they did that and so many other things, including, for the very, very first time in this nation's history, they sanctioned what I describe as, in everything but name, torture.
Yeah, right, which was horrible. You write early on about Addington and Cheney were deeply engrossed in intense legal discussions, the burning question of the moment, which would develop into the signature issue of the coming Bush years, how far the president's powers could be extended in order to fight this new foe. The pressures felt by the White House lawyers to push the limits were extraordinary, and they were also successful. Why were they successful? Why wasn't there a whole lot more questioning about this very, very radical change in who America was?
Well, to tell you the truth, at the time, almost nobody knew about it. There were what little bits did come out, for instance, there was, I think on November 13th, 2001, was when the plan to try terror suspects in military tribunals was made public. At that point, there were a number of people, both inside and outside, who were appalled because the tribunals were like a star chamber. I mean, they were ridiculous. They had no sort of due process, really. And so some of the military people who really understand the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which has its own version of law with its own due process, they spoke up inside the administration. And there were a few civil liberties lawyers outside the administration who took note and started getting involved. But basically, most of these decisions took place behind closed doors. And when there was dissent, such as the military at that point, the dissenters were pushed out. You have to understand how extraordinary this time was. There were a handful of people, I mean, really just a tiny handful of people, basically five lawyers and the vice president and a few other people, who pretty much set the entire course on how America, the legal foundation on which America fought the war on terror, and almost nobody else saw these decisions. We still haven't seen some of them. I mean, there are memos from this period that are still being hidden from Congress.
Hmm. And what's John Ashcroft doing today on the Hill? He's talking some about what kind of torture was going on, or at least that's what Congress would like for him to talk about.
Well, unfortunately, I can't see the hearings where I am, so I am dying to find out what he's going to really say.
You're on the radio.
But, this is an interesting period right now, I feel very lucky that this book came out at this moment, because Congress is now finally showing a little bit of spine, backbone. They are beginning to ask questions about what really happened here in this chapter of our history. And it's been a political hot potato that really, in truth, most people in both parties have not wanted to take on. People have been cast as unpatriotic for asking about this and questioning it. And if anything else is taken from this book, I hope people who read it will see that there are a lot of ways to show patriotism, and one is to fight for the country, and another is to fight inside for its ideals. And a lot of lawyers inside and other people did that. They didn't necessarily win. It's not decided yet, though. I think we're at a turning point.
Right. One of the things that has always bothered me, and you write about this, are the number of people who have been held at Guantanamo, some of whom have been tortured, many of whom, as you indicate, are totally innocent, Jane. I don't know how we can allow that to happen.
Well, you know, one of the most disturbing little anecdotes in this book was that as early as the late summer of 2002, a CIA officer who was an expert in Islamic fundamentalism and spoke Arabic was sent down to Guantanamo to figure out what was going on down there. This is so early on. Yeah. There were worries because the government wasn't getting good intelligence out of the detainees down there, and everyone wanted to know, why aren't we getting more? So he was sent down to try to interview some of the detainees as an expert, and he came back with really distressing news, which he wrote up in a report and gave to the very top people in the White House. And what his opinion was that approximately a third of the detainees in Guantanamo were innocent. They just had the wrong people, he thought. And there were some serious bad guys and are still some serious terror suspects down there. But he told them that long ago that a third of the population were mistaken. And what happens next when the White House gets this news is that a couple of the lawyers, John Bellinger, who is now the top lawyer in the State Department, at that time he was the lawyer for Condi Rice at the NSC, it was really disturbed, of course. I mean, it's not America's tradition to lock up innocent people without trial indefinitely. So he and a military general, John Gordon, went to the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, at that point, and said, you've got to look at this report. We've got to do something about this. But Gonzalez was joined in this meeting by the vice president's legal counsel, David Addington, who I mentioned earlier. Right. And Addington was a formidable character, and he just bullied them into submission, basically, and said, we are not going back on this decision. Hmm. The president has said that all of the people down there are enemy combatants, we're not going back on this. And so even though there was reliable information, not from ACLU lawyers, but from their own people in the CIA, that they had the wrong people, the vice president's lawyer didn't want to hear about it. And Alberto Gonzalez, who of course became the attorney general, didn't do anything about it. So, it's disturbing. I mean, and what the military general Gordon and Bellinger argued at that point was, you know, this isn't how America works.
Right. No, it isn't how America works. It's amazing that the president says this is the way it is, and that's supposed to be the way it is. They're all enemy combatants.
Well,
who's he listening to?
That follows actually from that's a consequence of a really fateful decision that was made very early on after September 11th, which was when Bush decided to throw over the Geneva Conventions and say that they don't apply to terror suspects, what they basically did was they put this whole community of suspects outside the law. And, you know, I understand why people at that time felt, you know, they're not prisoners of war, really. They're not, I mean, I personally think they're criminals, but at any rate, they took away the rules. And one of the most important rules in the Geneva Conventions is that they have a system set up to screen who you've got. Mm. So when you take prisoners on a battlefield, you give them a sort of a mini trial to figure out, are they innocent bystanders,
sure,
or are they, you know, truly suspects in something nefarious? And they got rid of that. They just took, you know, whole groups of people and sent them to Guantanamo instead.
And some of them were there because of bounty hunters, right?
Absolutely. According to a study that was later done by the Seton Hall Law School, 55% of them were probably, according to Seton Hall, were innocent. And only 8% had anything to do with Al-Qaeda. And many of the innocent ones had just been sold by people who wanted to, you know, cash in. And in fact, there were also some people who were sent to Guantanamo as a result of personal grudges. There was one suspect who was sent there by someone who had been given a bad grade by the suspect when the suspect was his teacher.
Oh, no.
You know, there are all kinds of stories, really.
Oh, my. Tell me about, because I've always been confused about McCain, of all people who was tortured all those years, who understands this issue like very, very, very few Americans. You talk about his privately accusing Cheney of trying to create a secret police, and then Cheney trying to give McCain an ultimatum here. Can you tell me how McCain changed his position on this?
Well, McCain, of course, has this, you know, having been held as a POW in Vietnam for 5 years, suffered in ways that, you know, very few have, and truly has a gut reaction against torture.
Sure.
And so he was emotionally on board from the start. I think he was very, very disturbed by the Abu Ghraib pictures. And but politically, it was, as I said, a hot potato. It was something that was very hard for anyone in the Congress to oppose the administration on. Anyone who tried was castigated as being pro-terrorist. So there was a little while where the human rights groups were saying to Cheney, you know, if anybody can change this, you can. I mean, saying to McCain, if anyone can change this, you can. Because McCain had the standing, the moral standing, and he's mm-hmm. conservative, he was a, you know, veteran. But for a while, he didn't feel he could quite speak out. What he asked for, he said to some of these groups, I need some cover. And so one of the groups in particular, Human Rights First, arranged to have a number of military figures speak out, and they coordinated with McCain. And it was really when the leaders of the U.S. military, all the way up to John Vesey, who's a tremendously respected figure, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the past, They then spoke out. McCain felt he could speak out, and it was about at that point that he became really the leader in the Senate on the Republican side against these issues. Some Democrats, Richard Durbin in particular, had tried very hard to oppose these things earlier on, and there are a handful of other Democrats who were involved. But then, so then. It's all explained in the dark side. There's this sort of back and forth between McCain and Cheney's people, because Cheney's people are really leading the charge for what I and many other people think of as torture. Mm-hmm. And it was a real fight. And at some point more recently, I think McCain has pretty much, well, you can see that he's repositioned himself a little bit politically on this. And he's privately, I think I've heard that he's told people that he feels like if he's really going to change anything, he's got to get elected president. Hmm. So he's not going to be way out on a limb on this, because it puts him at odds with the Bush administration.
Hmm. But it doesn't put him at odds with the American people, do you think?
Well, you know, it depends what poll you look at. Some polls say people in this country, about half the people, support the idea of you know, anything goes, use torture. I think that American public opinion, it depends on, you know, things like seeing shows like 24 on Fox. Do they, you know, if people believe that torture works, they tend to think that maybe it's necessary. And one of the things I've tried to do in this book is go back carefully over what the people who really were close to these cases said about whether the torture did work. And I think that what people will tell you is that in many cases they got really bad information out of people. Torture will make someone talk, won't necessarily make them tell the truth. Hmm. And there have been some terrible consequences when people who we have coerced have given us false information that we've believed.
Let's welcome phone calls for Jane, and we'll take them in a moment. She's the author of The Dark Side, just released, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. It's just been released this week, actually. She's the co-author of two best-selling and critically acclaimed narrative nonfiction books, Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984 to 1988, and Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. She's a Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jane Mayer is our guest. Her book is The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. It has just been published by Doubleday. Ray from Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I actually have two questions, but they're both related. The first one is, doesn't anybody find it strange that after 9/11, Bush and Cheney refused to give testimony under oath, and they also insisted that they had to testify together, and we could have actually got so much more information as a nation from those two gentlemen had they testified under oath about what happened on that day, and had they testified separately. Now, my second part is, they testified together that they had spoken on the phone on the morning of 9/11, and that they were in direct contact as that final plane was coming into the Pentagon, coming into Washington, D.C. Now, if you read the 9/11 report, it clearly states there is no official records of those phone calls. Bush has his first official phone call on the morning of 9/11 at 10:03, and it's to Donald Rumsfeld. That is the first official phone call. Now, why has nobody dug into these questions? Where are the phone records to prove these two were in contact? And second, why isn't anybody saying that it's very unusual they had to testify together and not under oath?
Hi there. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about testify to the 9/11 Commission, when the 9/11 commissioners came to interview them. There has been some written. There's been some writing about this. There's a book that Charlie Savage, who's now a writer for the New York Times, wrote that explores this a little bit. And it is curious that when the 9/11 Commission wanted to interview both the president and the vice president, that they insisted on being together. It was as if they had to kind of coordinate their testimony, and they were afraid they might contradict each other if they were put in separate rooms talking. The issue of what those phone calls goes to the authority to shoot down a plane. Cheney famously gave orders allowing the U.S. military to shoot down a plane if they thought that it was suspicious. And the question is, did he have the authority as vice president to do that, or did the president, as commander-in-chief, make that call? And Cheney's always said that the president made that call, but there's kind of some contradiction in the phone records. I think what does this all add up to? It's an early glimpse at something that's very, very hard to get to the bottom of, which is, what is the power relationship between the vice president and the president? Who calls the shots, really? And I think in the dark side, from what I was able to tell, an enormous number of the really important decisions emanated from the vice president's office, at least on the war on terror. And perhaps that was one of the first ones.
Thanks very much for the call. Can you spend a few minutes, you spend more than that in the book, about how these signals of what was going on and the fact that there might be an attack, and that we had some clues that were so obvious and given to sources that should have done something about it, whether or not this could have been prevented?
Well, yeah, I begin by taking a look at the 9/11 attacks for the reason that the whole rationale for why we need to basically brutalize terror suspects has been that we missed the 9/11 attacks, and so we need to be tougher and take these extra measures. So I went back to take a look and see, why did we miss the terror attacks? Was it because we were not brutalizing terror suspects? Was that really the problem? Mm. And what I believe from looking very carefully through the 9/11 Commission report and interviewing many people around it who were involved was that it was a completely different problem. We misdiagnosed the disease and have prescribed the wrong medicine, and we've prescribed, in fact, medicine that's made it worse. What caused 9/11? People who will read this book can see a very careful retelling of what went wrong. And on one level, it was quite simple. And I quote Jack Clunan, who's a former FBI agent who was a counterterrorism expert and very much involved in tracking al-Qaeda before 9/11. And he says, basically, it was just garden variety incompetence. Mm-hmm. A handful of people did not do their jobs right. The CIA had word that two terror suspects, members of al-Qaeda, came to America a year before 9/11. And for a variety of kind of bureaucratic reasons, the CIA failed to tell the FBI about this. So the FBI did not realize that there were two al-Qaeda suspects inside America. Those two became two of the hijackers on 9/11. Hmm. No one was watching them because the CIA forgot to tell the FBI. Now, the FBI had its own problems, too. It's not to say that one piece of the bureaucracy was perfect and the other wasn't. There were problems on both sides. But Jack Clunan says, he asked himself, he's really quite obsessed with this at this point for a good reason, because he feels so horrible that this happened. And he says, was it preventable? He thinks it was. It would have maybe, things go wrong. Face it, humans make errors. Right. But this was a very big error. And the other part of it really is a little more complicated, but it's the political picture in Washington, which is that the politicians, people running the government, were not paying much attention. I mean, so even when they did receive information, and there actually were some very strong warnings percolating up about the growing threat from al-Qaeda, they paid very little attention to it. President Bush famously was briefed in August of 2001, and in a briefing that said, Al-Qaeda trying to attack America. And basically his reaction was kind of to sort of say, at least according to one published report, well, you covered your ass. You know, so he they didn't act on the information they did have. And anyway, I try to explain this whole thing. I think what's interesting to me as a reporter trying to put all the pieces of the puzzle together is to try to speculate on what effect would it have on people running this government to realize that, in essence, they just missed it because they weren't paying enough attention or because of, you know, rank incompetence. Their first reaction was to say, let's not play the blame game. They didn't want anybody investigating it. They didn't want anyone to really take too close a look. Instead, they quickly changed the deflected attention to say, we're going to have to be a whole lot tougher and we're going to have to do a whole bunch of new things. And it is true, they certainly needed to be paying more attention, but did they need to start torturing people? You know, there really was no reason to think they did.
Yeah. Peter from Madison, hi.
Thank you, Kathleen, for taking the call. I want to commend the author for her fantastic work and, you know, exposing these issues. One comment specifically is something very disturbing to me, because I really believe in the high principles of our country and the idea that as we move into the future, we are striving towards a better world, a better country, higher moral grounds. And this whole issue of torture and whether it works or not, the idea that people are willing to go along with it in such large numbers, don't they understand that it is the wrong moral thing to do, whether it works or not? That's not the issue. This, we just don't do it simply because it's expedient. And I'll take the comments off the air.
Thank you very much for the call.
Well, thank you very much for the praise. And I think it's a live debate in this country at this point, and some people certainly feel very much that way. Pretty much every single major religious organization of every religion has spoken out against this. So, you know, they occupy the moral pulpits in the country, and they've been uniformly against it. And, you know, the other thing is that when people are frightened, when a population is frightened, as the country was after 9/11, they cut corners. They sometimes do the wrong thing. There's a long history of that. But there's not a history in this country of torturing people. In fact, the country from the very beginning, with George Washington as the first general, said that they wanted to take the higher ground. They blazed the trail on human rights. No country's really done more to fight for human rights and to sort of show how to be civilized in wartime than America has. And America really took the lead role in drafting the Geneva Conventions. These were not international laws imposed on this country. These were international laws written by this country. The original documents sit in the State Department. These incorporate American ideals that have been sacred to the country since its founding. So I that's why I think that what started as a war for the country's security, the war on terror, really became a battle for its soul.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk more, because I've wondered about these tapes. You write about the CIA destroying interrogation videotapes. Why did they do that? And do we have any idea what might have been on those tapes, Jane?
Yeah, it's this is something that's under criminal investigation right now. So much is still not known, but there's plenty I'd love to know. And what I do know is from interviewing people that basically there were hundreds of hours of videotapes of the CIA's most brutal interrogations of the Al-Qaeda suspects, including the waterboarding of two of the suspects. The waterboarding in particular is, I'm told, a hideous thing to behold. So, you know, people struggle for their lives in it. And so when the Abu Ghraib photographs came out, which people will remember, it sent a chill, really a panic through the CIA, because they knew in their vaults they had hundreds of hours, not just of still pictures, which were creating havoc politically around the world. Mm. They had live film footage of something even worse. Mm. And it was not the work of a few low-level servicemen, as they claimed Abu Ghraib was. It was part of a a very deliberate program that was approved at the highest levels of our government. So what would it have looked like if people had seen those tapes? They suddenly, one person I interviewed says in the book, a light bulb went off and it was like, uh-oh. They realized that it could be what another person says, unmanageable would have been the reaction to those tapes. So, not surprisingly, not so long afterwards, those tapes were destroyed. And what was on them? Well, we know the interrogation of these two suspects was on them, hundreds and hundreds of hours of it. And some other fairly disturbing stuff was caught on film. It may have been on closed circuit rather than on those videotapes, but it included the psychic destruction of one of the terror suspects, Abu Zubaydah, who was already in, I think, pretty rocky mental shape when he was picked up. At least that's what the theory of many FBI and CIA officers is. And when he was being subjected to all kinds of just terrible things they were doing to him, locking him up in a little dog cage and not letting him out, things like that, he kind of lost it. And according to several sources I interviewed, he became sort of sexually obsessed and abusive to himself. He just kept masturbating to the point where they began to think that he was going to harm himself and had to bring in doctors. And so that was on tape, too.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Jeez. Horrible to hear about. I hope I haven't offended anybody with family listeners.
It's all right. We hear about all this stuff now. All families are. And why would they have taped all of this?
They taped it for, well, you know, this is where I speculate just from having interviewed people and asked them the same thing. One, sort of quality control reasons. They wanted to make sure that what they were doing the way they were supposed to be doing it.
So
they would show it to the top people in Langley, where the CIA is based, to make sure that they'd gotten it right. They also wanted other experts to listen to whatever confessions they'd gotten from the terrorists and see if they were missing anything or if they could piece it together in some way. And then I have been told by a number of former CIA officers, they think it was also for voyeuristic purposes. I mean, everybody wanted in on this. I can't convey well enough the atmosphere, but there was a great excitement about this in some parts of the government where people just wanted to see it.
Oh my gosh!
She's still there. A CIA officer who I cannot name, who was involved in the terror program, flew over to see Khalid Sheikh Mohammed waterboarded because she was so excited that they'd gotten him, and she just wanted to watch. And she was chastised by others at the CIA, according to my sources, for the bosses said, you know, this is not supposed to be entertainment.
Whew. Let's go to Richard from Fox Point. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Jane, first I want to say that I'm sympathetic with a great deal of what you're outlining here and what's in your book. I've worked in security and with intelligence people for years, talking, giving speeches around the world, and I'm familiar with the data. What something, though, may be missing, and it's missing from the macro view, and I want to suggest that we look at it. You describe people saying the way Cheney changed based on how he looked as if he had seen something, and that's exactly what happened. It's called secondary trauma. And the people I've talked to who have both tortured for many years now, this is not new, and so I disagree with your characterization of our history, both tortured and been tortured often respond to the trauma with predictable behaviors, one of which is a very binary view of good and evil. It drives you into a place where what you've described is characterized by secondary trauma and its symptoms of seeing good and evil in a binary way, and it leads to a more simplistic viewpoint in the macro view than is justified. And the people I've talked to who have seen what they call, quote, the face of evil, let's leave that undefined, are changed by their work, especially over time. And so it strikes me that when you talk about we don't have a history of torture, it's not true. When we've trained people all over the world to do it, I'm sure you know that. When you talk about mini hearings on the battlefield, it's clear that you've not been on the battlefield, any battlefield, because that's just not what's so. So the people I talked to long ago distinguished between paranoia and appropriate paranoia. And in the security world, including information security, appropriate paranoia is the way the work is characterized because of the nature of the threat. I talked to a ranking guy at CIA who couldn't sleep at night listening to the transcripts from the FISA intercepts, justifiably done, because he listened daily to what people were planning to do here. 9/11 was not a single incident where incompetence screwed it up. It was part of, a macro view. And so what I'm not hearing is you giving more than lip service to the impact of people on the ground and on the line who are confronting the realities of war and terror, and also in a context of what we have done globally, training people all over the world to do torture, doing it scientifically from the Shah of Iran, from Mossadegh's overthrow all the way forward. Would you speak to that issue, especially the issue of secondary trauma and whether or not you, as I was told by a therapist, might be affected by secondary trauma as well from your intensive interaction with people who are telling you things it's not a surprise that people wanted to see the videotapes. I've talked to a head of a station in South America. Friday night was movie night. All of the surveillance tapes that were done, it was movie night. The sexual setups, the blackmail, this is standard operating procedure. So that's what I'm responding to.
All right,
well,
thanks.
Lots to respond to, and a lot of interesting points. Mm-hmm. In terms of what I'm saying is different in American history here, the caller's certainly right. There's been in every war there is overstepping. There's abuse. It's we all know that there've been individuals who've tortured people. There've been all kinds of things that have gone wrong in every conflict that America's involved in and that everybody else has been involved in. But what was different here from any other conflict the United States has been involved in was in this war, the war on terror, from the very top of our government on down, abuse was sanctioned as state policy for American servicemen and officers of the United States government to themselves inflict on captives. It's never been so before, as far as I know. If the caller knows something otherwise, he can, I'm a reporter and always looking for more facts, but as far as I know and as far as I've been told, this is really a sea change for the United States. Now, have we trained others to do it? I think in the Phoenix program in Vietnam, I think in the School of the Americas in South America, Central America, maybe in Iran, I don't know enough about it. There's certainly been the export from the United States of some of these tactics in the past, and most of them were developed by the CIA in secrecy during the Cold War, and so there's long been a lot of research done by the United States government into coercion, and particularly into psychological coercion, which is a really strange and powerful tool that was used in this war on terror on our detainees. But it's never been sanctioned as state policy from the top the way it was here for our own people to do, and that really I think is a tremendous moral, ethical, political, and legal distinction that I think we're only just beginning to kind of grapple with. I don't know much about secondary trauma, so I can't really speak to it, but I do think that I describe in this book, I really tried very hard, and you'll, if you read it, which I really hope people pick it up, because it describes how 9/11 and these attacks and the ongoing threat of terror did very much affect the judgment of the people running the country.
Yes.
One of the things I write about is the something that I feel people haven't paid much attention to but is really interesting, which is that after 9/11, Cheney in particular distrusted the CIA, for which he felt had missed the coming attacks, and demanded to see the raw intelligence that the CIA gathered on threats to America. And it was no longer filtered as it had been before 9/11. He just saw everything that came in over the transom. And according to Roger Cressy, who was at the National Security Council, much of it was garbage,
mm-hmm.
but it completely, they were bombarded with it, and they still are. Every morning they start the day mm-hmm. looking at this, you know, every conceivable thing that could be done to the United States. And people tell me it's so upsetting, it's like being locked in a room with Led Zeppelin music.
Well, it could drive you crazy if that's how you start your day and then you worry about it all day long, right?
Well, very much. And the caller's also right that I think that this program it has had just very traumatic effects on the people who've been involved in it, mm-hmm. some of them. I mean, you know, I've talked to one CIA officer whose friend was involved in waterboarding people, and I haven't been able to talk to his friend. He's still in the CIA, but I haven't been able to talk to the waterboarder, but I've talked to his friend, and the friend says that he can't sleep at night. He's just destroyed in many ways, and you cannot go to that far into that dark a place without it affecting you.
Yeah. All right, let's pause for a moment. Thanks, Richard, very much for your interesting call. We will move to other calls in a moment. Jane Mayer is our guest. Her book is The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. 800-486-8655 is the number, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls now, and let's go to Daniel from Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Famously, Nixon said, if the president does it, it is legal. Would you expect Bush to pardon people like Rumsfeld, Gonzalez, Rice, Cheney, and those who condoned and committed torture before he leaves office as the ultimate cover-up and perversion of justice?
Great question. And, you know, I think if there were serious criminal proceedings, if he felt that any of these people were likely to face charges of some sort, I would anticipate that President Bush would pardon them all. They have not regarded any of these practices as crimes. And they've worried that other people will, but they have, as you quote Nixon, interpreted the Constitution to place the president, when he's commander-in-chief, above the law.
Thanks, Daniel, for the call. Scott from Columbus. Hi, Scott.
Thank you for taking my call. I would recommend to your guest check out the documentary Sir, No Sir, and it has a film from the Winter Soldier hearings regarding My Lai massacre and the Phoenix program. That was a program that was hatched in think tanks in the Pentagon in the United States. It was the definition of terrorism is a systematic use of violence in order to terrorize a people, and that is exactly what that was. It was sanctioned from the top, and it killed thousands of civilians, men, women, children. And it was not an isolated case. That's the official story and the official cover-up. But if you talk to Vietnam vets who were on the ground, specifically the special features, Joe Urgo, U-R-G-O, who's still active in the peace movement, a Vietnam vet, in that documentary, Sir, No, Sir. There's also a history of systematic torture within the United States. I recommend Douglas Blackman's new book, Slavery by Another Name. Jim Thompson, former governor of Illinois, put a moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois because it was discovered that there was torture going on in precincts in Chicago, including waterboarding, extracting confessions, and that was one of the main, in the 90s, that was one of the main reasons he declared a moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois in the late 90s. So we have a long, long history of officially sanctioned torture right in this country, not only exporting it.
Gene.
Well, I still think if you take a look at this book, The Dark Side, I think what we're dealing with is a new evolution of this, something different. It was, you know, not something that was just done out in the field somewhere or in extremis in a precinct house someplace. This was a program that was deliberate from the top down that included creating black prison sites around the world where they were specifically chosen so that they would be outside of the law and outside of any supervision and in secret where nobody could see what was going on. There were cadres of agents inside the CIA who were trained as muscle simply to go around the world and kidnap people and bring them to these black sites. There were very, very specific and meticulous, detailed instructions on every single thing that was done to these people that were checked back to Langley. It was so carefully controlled that it was almost like that children's game Mother May I, where every time they wanted to slap somebody in the belly, they'd send a cable to Langley saying, "Can we do the belly slap?" And the answer would come back, "Yes or no." "Can we extend the sleep deprivation another hour?" "Yes or no." This thing was so bureaucratized that it really took this to a level that I don't think this country's ever been to before. Again, you know, open to correction always, and certainly not infallible. But I've interviewed so many people about this, and I really feel that if you read the book, you'll see how it was a whole new level.
Yeah, and how many people you interviewed. Thanks, Jane, so much for being with us. It's an important book. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Jane Mayer, the book is The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. It has just been published by Doubleday, and Jane is currently Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm on vacation for a couple weeks, back in August. This is the Ideas Network.